Okay. This is a complicated book. And sometimes I find that I get so lost in the details that I can't get the big picture. So what I've tried to do tonight on this handout is give you something that helps us kind of get the big picture of what's going on. And I think it helps us make a little more sense of the details when we see how they all fit together. And I thought of several ways to start this class. There's a whole lot of things I want to say and do before we actually start. But one of them is, we went through in chapter 6, six things that were going on, seals that were broken. Then in chapter 7, we had the interlude. And then we have the seventh and final seal broken in chapter 8. We get that. Now in chapters, and we're going to go about through that this handout in a minute, but in chapters 8 and 9, then we have the angels with the trumpets and the woes and so forth. And I've already made the case for you all that I think a whole lot of what's being condemned here is the problem that God's people have had with idolatry. And that goes all the way back to Genesis. For some reason, why is it that man feels compelled to get a piece of wood, carve it into a face, and then worship it and give it credit for things? The whole mindset of idolatry baffles me. I don't know why. I mean, the guy who is worshiping this wood-carved idol has to remember just yesterday this was a tree, and I've carved it up to look like a lizard or a bear or a man or whatever it is, and now I'm worshiping it. And I'm thinking, what kind of logical nonsense is that? But anyway, there's that. Now, the reason why I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit, we're going to look at a verse together that I think supports what I think is going on in chapters 8 and 9, where God is really displeased with the idolatry that was going on. Well, he's been displeased with it all along. We read 24 verses from 10 different books from the New Testament that condemned idolatry 4 or 5 weeks ago. You got that in that handout, I think. And I think God is just as irritated with what's going on in the Roman Empire with emperor worship. There's a handout on the back table. But she doesn't want it. That's the one on the far left. I think God is irritated with that. And I think one of the subjects, it's logical to conclude, maybe I have to say logical to guess, but I think it's a logical guess that idolatry is a big part of what's going on in chapters 8 and 9. Now, but that's not going to be obvious to you if I were in your shoes and you hear me talking about some idolatry going on in chapters 8 and 9 and idolatry is being punished. You'd say, well, where in the world are you getting that? So I'm going to show you the verse. Chapters 8 and 9 are really, they could be without division, one narrative going on about the same thing. But turn over with me, if you would, please, to the end of chapter 9. And we're reading all this nasty stuff about destruction that's happening. And then we get down to verse 20. And listen to what it says. And the rest of mankind, who were not killed by these plagues, did not repent of the works of their hands, so as not to worship demons and the idols of gold, of silver, of brass, of stone, of wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. Well, what's he talking about? Why is God irritated? Why are people dying in chapters 8 and 9? Idolatry. Well, we're going to develop this more next week, but if you have a mind that's set on idolatry and you're worshiping some figment of your imagination that you've carved out of a tree or gold or silver or whatever it is, then who are you not worshiping? Well, the one true God. So what goes along with the mind that no longer accepts God as the authority figure? Well, what happens there is you got verse 21. And they did not repent of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their immorality, nor of their thefts. In other words, what moral law are you going to follow if you've given up on the moral law that God gave us? Well, you're not going to do one. And I can't help but think about our own culture. At one time, we were called a Christian nation. I mean, that didn't even come close to being true anymore. I don't know what the percentages are, but I think there are more people now who claim not to be Christians than there are who claim to be Christians. So, anyway, when you hear me start talking about idolatry and stuff in chapters 8 and 9, I'm getting that because at the conclusion of what's going on in 8 and 9 are these verses where John is clearly condemning idolatry, right? Jesus is condemning idolatry through John. Okay. Something else let's look at. Well, let's go ahead and look at the handout I just gave you. This helped me to try to see the big picture of what's going on. We've already studied six of these things back in chapter 6. And then we have the interlude in chapter 7. And then we take up with the seventh breaking of the seal in chapter 8. And for those who weren't with us before, God has a scroll in his hand. It's got seven seals on it. Back in chapter 4 or 5, whichever one it was, they searched heaven and earth and all creation to find somebody who was worthy to open up the seals. Couldn't find anybody. And then Jesus appears as a lamb. And he was worthy to do it. So he starts opening each one of the seals. And with each one, with each seal comes a vision. And we've gone over the visions that were in chapter 6. And tonight we'll do the vision in chapter 7. But look at the logic of this. And I think it helps us put into perspective what John is seeing and what the Christians were supposed to get out of it and what we get out of it. And again, I told you one of the logical things that I try to keep in mind is what would a first century Christian conclude about this? So, starting in chapter 6, verse 2, the first seal was opened. We see a white horse. The rider is Jesus. He's conquering with his spiritual kingdom. Second seal is open. We see the red horse. Most scholars think that indicates blood that comes from warfare and bringing death to many people. Third seal is open. We see that black horse, which indicates mourning in most cultures. But we also see that the rider on that horse has scales in his hand, and we see the prices of basic commodities are given to us, and it indicates a scarcity of food and possibly oppression of Christians because they were cast aside if they did not succumb to the emperor worship. The fourth seal is open, and we see that sickly ashen horse, which indicates death to a fourth of the earth, which includes not only evil men, but Christian martyrs. The fifth seal opens, and the martyrs cried out. Remember that under the altar? How long until our blood is avenged? So look where we are so far when you see this. The white horse is Jesus saying, my spiritual kingdom is the dominant one. It's all powerful. I'm still conquering. That, of course, that's the church now. And then the second one, there's blood and warfare and people dying. And then the third one, there's mourning, there's scarcity of food and problems. And then we have the fourth one, the ashen horse, indicates more death, up to a quarter of the earth. People are dying. I mean, things are in bad shape. And then the fifth one, the martyrs who've been persecuted and killed unfairly, totally, of course, are crying out, how long until our blood is avenged? Why did this happen to us? And isn't it normal for us when bad things happen to us to say this isn't fair? Why me? Okay, now what we get in verses in the sixth and seventh seals, we won't get to seven till tonight, but in the sixth seal, we get a response to the Christians' question. There's an earthquake. The sun becomes black. The moon becomes like blood. Stars fell to the earth. The sky split apart, and mountains moved out of their places. And that is symbolic language for the wrath of God against evil empires, governments, and evil men. Now, I tried to make this case for you last time, I think. What would the first century Christian logically conclude in application of this truth? Well, he'd think, Rome stinks. I'm being persecuted. All this bad stuff is going on. I guess what God is trying to tell me is he's been doing this all along. We know that by reading the Old Testament, nations being used to punish nations. And when somebody gets evil enough, God brings in somebody to overthrow them. And so the first century Christian would think, I guess that's what's going to happen here. But it doesn't say that exactly. So, I'm trying to logically think, what would a Christian in 96 AD think about this? I think he would apply it to Rome. All right, now tonight we're going to get into the opening of the seventh seal. And the seventh seal is opened in chapter 8, verses 1 through 5, which we'll look at in just a minute. But what we have in verses 1 through 5 is there is an angel who is standing at a golden altar. And that angel adds much incense to the prayers of all the saints. And I don't think it's an accident that it's the prayers of all the saints. So, would that be just the martyred saints? Well, that's not what it says. We've already heard the prayers of the martyred saints back in chapter 6, verses 9 and 10. Now we have an angel standing at the golden altar who is adding incense to the prayers of all the saints. And I would take that to mean all of God's people since Adam. Were they Christians? No. They weren't any Christians until Jesus came. But God, they were spiritual. They were Israel, physical Israel, and the other people who followed God's moral law. But then the smoke and the prayers of the saints went up before God. So God hears the prayers of all Christians, of all of his people. The angel, and what did the angel do? He's standing at the altar, and he's just throwing much incense onto the altar. And the smoke goes up before God with the prayers of the saints. And then the angel, who's there tending to the altar, threw fire from the altar to the earth. And in most of the cases where the earth is mentioned, it symbolizes the wicked people on earth. So the angel throws fire from the altar down to the earth. And then what results from that is thunder, lightning, and an earthquake, which symbolize God's powerful judgment on wicked men. Now what this is, I think, it's logical to conclude, is reassurance to the martyred saints who asked, how long until our blood is avenged? Now the question is still not directly answered. You know, it's not like, 3 more years, 5 more years, 60 more years. But they can rest assured that they will be avenged eventually. Well, anybody want to comment about that? Does that make sense? Nobody's nodding yes or no, so I'll take that to mean that everyone agrees. Now, let's go over and look at one other little thing that I'm not ready to get to yet, but I want to get there. Look at this note, because this applies to everything we're going to talk about tonight and next week. There is no mention in this chapter, which is chapter 8, of a specific evil nation or empire. The Roman Empire is not mentioned. There's no mention of a specific evil nation or empire that would suffer God's wrathful punishment. It's possible, and I think this is probably true, it is possible that John is simply being assured of God's general policy of punishing wicked men on his own schedule. It's his time, not ours, throughout history. And we have evidence of that all the way through the Old Testament. Nevertheless, and I think this is true, the logical conclusion for Christians who are living at the time of the writing of the book would be to apply the policy that they're being reassured about, apply that policy to God's judgment and eventual destruction of the Roman Empire. This is the way, in other words, to put it in our lingo, this is the way God operates. A nation comes up because he allows it to come up. And then they go into moral depravity and idolatry and sleaze, like it's happening in the United States. And God tolerates it only so long. And then he brings along somebody to wipe them out. And that somebody who wipes them out is not necessarily somebody better. You know, to get mildly political about it, who are the biggest forces who could take us out? Well, China, obviously, would be our number one fear. Russia, I'm not so sure about, because they're not doing such a hot job in Ukraine. But, you know, is China a wonderful place? Spiritually with it? Hardly. They're godless and all of that. But God has taken godless nations in the past to wipe out and punish other godless nations when they get bad enough. So I think it would be logical for the first century Christians to conclude, well, this is the way God does business. Anybody who's familiar with the Old Testament would know he's done this numerous times in the past, so he's probably going to do it again. We might not be alive to see it, but we think it's going to happen. And it does answer our question, when is our death going to be avenged? Any comments about that? Okay. Well, now let's go to where we're supposed to be. All that was the introduction. Chapter 8. The narrative resumes now. And remember, chapter 7 was the chapter we call the interlude, because we went through 6 of these seals in chapter 6. Then we go to the interlude in chapter 7. And Jesus breaks the 7th seal, and it says there's silence for a half an hour. That's dramatic. What would that, remember all the worship that was going on in chapter 7? The worship of the four living creatures and the elders and the angels and all this worship going on like crazy. And that stops. Silence. Well, why would that be? We can only speculate. But if somebody generates a circumstance to you and says, and guess what happens next? And then they stop talking. What do you do? What do you want to say? Well, tell us. What happened next? So it could be that that's what's going on here for John. There's silence for a half. Now, was that a half hour in John's time? I don't know. Or was that a half hour in vision time? I don't know. I'm not smart enough to know the answer to that. But in verse 2, we see that 7 angels show up, and each one of them is given a trumpet. But they don't start doing their thing until verse 6. Then we start reading about the angels, and every time they blow a trumpet, something bad happens. There were 7 of them. Were there actually 7? Probably not, because we know 7 is a number of completeness. There was some number that indicates that all the angels that were needed were there. Each one had a trumpet, and after each one blew the trumpet, a woe happened. So you hear about the 7 woes in Revelation. Each one accompanies one of these angels who's blowing a trumpet. Then we have the angel who stood at the golden altar, which is probably different from the altar in 6:9. 6:9 was the altar under which the martyrs were when they cried out, how much longer until we're avenged? And if we have time, I probably killed too much time already, but there were 2 altars back in the tabernacle. One of them was outside in a common ground that everybody had access to. Then there was the altar in the Holy of Holies, which the high priest went into only one time a year. And that's where God met the people, met the high priest representing the people there. So I can make the case, if we have time, I'll go back and make the case for you, that the angel stood at the golden altar, which is the one that was in the holiest of holies back in the Old Testament of days. And that's different from the one under which the martyrs were, which was called the bronze altar. And that's the one that was accessible to everybody. The altar symbolized the altars in the Hebrew tabernacle. The altar in 6:9 symbolized the bronze altar of daily sacrifice that was in the tabernacle courtyard. And there are the scriptures for that if you want to look at it. The altar in 8:3 symbolized the golden altar of atonement in the holiest of holies. And it was used only once per year by the high priest. And it's mentioned in Hebrews 9:7. You know, Hebrews has a whole lot in there about the old law and the new law and so forth. And in Hebrews 9:7, it talks about the fact that the high priest went in there once a year. Incense was added to the prayers of all the saints before God, not just those who were martyred. And then while the angel is there tending to this altar, what he does is take a censer full of fire and sling it down to the earth. That seems logical to conclude when the Christians who were martyred said, when are we going to get vengeance? Remember, we'll let God do the avenging. But also we got the prayers of all saints, including all those who've ever been mistreated. This is God's response to them. Because remember, the angel there was throwing the incense into the prayers of all the saints, not just the martyred saints. So there's that. Anybody want to make a comment or ask a question about this? Okay. Isn't it easy to get lost in the detail of all this? And then you've got to become an Old Testament expert. I'm no Old Testament expert, but I can read what other people say. Okay. Now in verse 7, we have the first angel who sounds his trumpet. Well, they sounded trumpets for various reasons back then, but one of the reasons they sounded them back in the Old Testament days was to draw attention, to signal we're going to have a big meeting, or to signal danger, or to signal everybody pay attention, the big announcement's about to happen. So the first angel sounded his trumpet, and look what happens. Hail and fire are brought down, and they symbolize God's destruction on earth. And there are several Old Testament passages, which I did not list up there, but if you want them, I can give them to you after class, where hail is used to symbolize God's judgment on evil people. So I mentioned several times, that John is really in the class of Old Testament prophets, the apocalyptic language and the whole thing. As he sees these visions, he's just a whole lot like Ezekiel and Daniel, Isaiah. Okay, it says it's also mixed with blood. Well, whose blood is that? Well, who's being judged? Wicked men. So it's mixed with the blood of wicked men. And it says a third of the earth is destroyed, making life on earth difficult. Now, a third of the earth, if you look at it, all the growth, all that kind of stuff that's on the earth, that's a big chunk of the earth, but it's not total destruction. And I think that's meaningful, because that helps us make a logical conclusion about, are we talking about the end of the world, or are we talking about judgment at a certain time period? And I think the fact that a third of the earth is destroyed tells us we're talking about judgment, punishment, on, it's not the end of time. It's on a nation. Now keep in mind what we looked at a minute ago. It doesn't say Roman Empire. So the only way that we can really put the Roman Empire into this is by thinking, what would the first century Christian logically conclude? Okay. So it says a third is being destroyed. That's partial destruction. Not everyone nor everything is being destroyed, and that means that two-thirds is still left. Well, I'll get to that later. Okay, then you look at 8 and 9. The second angel sounded his trumpet. And what we find there is that a mountain is thrown into the sea. And what that probably indicates is the destruction of a world empire. And I put in parentheses there, Rome with a question mark. Because it doesn't say the Roman Empire. But again, I think the first century Christians would logically conclude that. And if you want to find out where is that symbol used in the past, Jeremiah 51:25 talks about an empire being destroyed with a mountain being thrown into the sea. A third of the sea is blood. A third of the sea creatures die. A third of the ships are sunk. And that symbolizes the negative impact of the fall of the kingdom. this kingdom that is being judged. Then the third angel sounds a trumpet, and a great star falls from heaven. Now, if you look back at Old Testament prophecy, and the one I listed for you here is Isaiah 14:4-12. Both Isaiah 14 is the chapter, and the verses are 4 and 12. Put them together, and it tells you we're talking about the evil rulers, in this case, the king of Babylon. So I think we're talking about the fall of a ruler. And what would a first century Christian conclude? Well, the Roman emperor. The burning torch would came into the water, and that would indicate his negative impact. Then we have wormwood. Wormwood is interesting. I don't know what wormwood was, but whatever it was, it's described as being very bitter. And back in the Old Testament, bitter wormwood was often associated with idolatry. That's the case in Deuteronomy 29:18. It's also the case in Jeremiah 9:13-15. Wormwood is a very bitter. Does anybody know what wormwood is, really? Do y'all know? You know what it is, Jeremiah? I don't really know what kind of wood it is, but whatever it is, it must be very bitter, and it's almost always associated with idolatry. Well, what kind of taste does idolatry leave in God's mouth? Bitter. Bitter water symbolized the evil impact of idolatry, which causes spiritual death.
Bob?
Yes.
What I'm finding is wormwood is actually an herb.
An herb?
Yeah, and it's got oils. So.
Okay, is it talking about bitterness?
It may be poisonous.
Ah. Even better. Okay, thank you. All right, in verse 12, the fourth angel sounds his trumpet, and again we have the third. And remember, the third indicates a big chunk, but not total destruction. I think that's meaningful, because we're going to see a third all the way through this chapter, and we see a third again in chapter 9. The fourth angel sounds the trumpet, a third of the sun, the moon, and the stars were darkened, and the Old Testament prophets used the symbolic reaction of heavenly bodies to God's judgment on evil men. For example, when Ezekiel, in chapter 12, verses 7 and 8, talks about God's judgment against Pharaoh, he uses the same kind of thing. The darkened day and night symbolize God's judgment against evil men. The sun gets dark, the moon gets dark, stars fall out of the sky, things get bloody. All that sort of thing. So it's very hard to understand Revelation if we don't know anything about what the Old Testament prophets said and the way they talked, because John talks the same way. All right, in 13, the first four angels each describe God's judgment in a different way. Each one of those was different. Let's go back and just review that one more time. There were the first trumpet sounds, and God's judgment is symbolized by hail and fire mixed with blood. The second angel sounds. God's judgment is symbolized by a mountain, often referring to an empire, that's thrown into the sea, and there's blood and death and all kinds of other associated things going with it. Then the third trumpet sounds, and God's judgment is symbolized by a great star that falls from heaven that often indicates the destruction of a ruler who is evil. So what we have here is we have the judgment of evil people symbolized by hail and fire and blood, and by a mountain being thrown into the sea, which refers to possibly a nation, and then by a great star that falls from heaven, which possibly symbolizes the ruler of that nation. So it is logical. And it's three ways that these woes are described. And then the fourth one is where the sun, moon, and stars are darkened. And that symbolizes God's judgment on evil men. Now, it's going to get worse. In chapter 9, it's going to get worse, he says. There's an eagle that appears. No doubt it was a war eagle. Don't you think? But there are three angels with trumpets that remain. Four angels have blown their trumpets. There's three left. Because remember, we started out with seven of them. And John hears the eagle say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." There's three woes left, indicating that the trumpet blast from the remaining angels will be even worse for those who dwell on the earth. And that's the way it was revealed to John to describe the wicked men, those who dwell on the earth. Almost always refers to wicked men in Revelation. And the eagle flew in mid-heaven. Why he flew in mid-heaven, I don't know. However, if one were to use a little logic there, in flying in mid-heaven, it could be easily seen and easily heard. If that's not the answer, then I don't know what the answer is. Okay, now let's review this concluding note here. There is nothing in chapter 8 that mentions Rome, the Roman Empire, or the emperor. It's not in there. However, it's possible that what's going on here is John is simply being assured of God's general policy of punishing wicked men on his own schedule throughout history. Nevertheless, the logical conclusion for Christians living at the time of the writing of the book would be to apply God's policy that he's used all along to God's judgment and eventual destruction of the Roman Empire. Would that be comforting to a first century Christian who's being persecuted because he's a Christian? I think definitely so. Okay, now does anybody want to make a comment or ask a question? Don't ask me any questions because I don't know the answer. No, anybody want to make a comment or ask a question? Yes.
It reminds me so much of the children of Israel when they were leaving Egypt and the plagues that God brought upon Pharaoh. You know, Egypt was a very idolatrous place. They had a god for everything. What was so ironic was that the plagues that God brought upon them were against their own gods, and their false gods could do nothing about it. And it wasn't until almost towards the end of the plagues that the magicians started to realize, hey, this was the finger of God. And then the children of Israel said, whoa, just get out of here so that we don't die. And so, you know, that reminds me that somewhat here that the comfort is if, as a Christian, we're following God's law, we don't have anything to worry about. We have a hope and a trust in God. But if not, we're just like those idolaters, like the Egyptians, who, when you're in idolatry, that's all you can think about. Where did the children of Israel, of Egypt go when there were problems? Well, they went to their gods, but they did nothing for them. It didn't help them. They went right back deeper into it because where else did they have to go?
Yes, and you know, I mean, that's an excellent point. You know what's even sadder than that? Even sadder than that is Israel couldn't wait to get out of Egypt. And they hadn't been gone but a few days. And what were they saying? Let's go back. And are you kidding me? And that's the same situation that Christians were in and might be in. Maybe there's a sense in which symbolically we're in the same thing. Are we going to give in to the common idolatrous culture and live like heathens, like they're doing? Well, Israel said, yeah, let's do that. Let's go back. At least back there we had something to eat. And God said, well, I'm going to give you 40 years to think about it. Till y'all are dead. And tell me how bad you want to go back. Wow. Yeah, that's a good comment. Anybody else? Yes.
Sorry, just to add one more comment to that as a caveat. Makes you think that we need to think before we speak as well. Like you mentioned, the children of Israel were like, oh, yeah, oh, well, we'll just go back because we had it so good. But when they were there, it was, you know, so bad. What did Pharaoh do? Well, he took away the straw and made them actually go search for their own. And then he tasked them even harder. And it was very bad. Sometimes our minds get, well, so bad. Oh, I wish we could go back versus really focus on the here and now, where we are, and trusting in God, despite what may be going on around us, to realize and recognize, yes, it may be bad, but where are we going? Where am I going? Where am I leading my family to go? Then where does our focus need to be?
Yeah. Good comments. Ron, your brain, your wheels are turning. What do you have to say?
I missed something about the significance of the incense being increased to the angels so that they could give it to the saints for the prayers.
Oh.
How does all that?
The contrast for me was back in, was it chapter 6? Where the saints were under the altar, and that was the martyred saints. And that was under the altar that was out there in the common grounds for the common people. What this angel is doing, that was the bronze altar. This angel is in front of the golden altar. And what he is doing is adding, it says, much incense. I think it's interesting, he throws in much incense to the prayers of all the saints. It's not just the saints who've been martyred. It's the prayers of all the saints. And of course, if you look where the word saints came from, it means the sanctified ones, the holy ones. Well, were there any holy ones? Did God have a people before Jesus, before Christians? Well, yeah, he did. Loyal Israel was that. And then the people who would convert and adopt God's laws, the natural laws, Romans 1 talks about. So I think what this is talking about is God is aware of all of his people and their prayers, and he responds. Is that what you were asking?
I'm asking, is what does the incense represent? Does it represent?
Oh, the incense, that's what they did back in the Old Testament. When they were offering something to God, they throw incense on. And we talk about the sweet savor.
Yes.
S-A-V-O-R, going up to God. That's what the incense was. It was supposed to send a fresh, did God really care that there was incense coming up? Does God smell? I don't know. I doubt that. But it's for man. It enhanced the worship experience with incense that smelled good to go up to God. We need symbolism to understand this stuff. Does that help?
Yeah.
Anybody else? Well, if you want to see about this, if we had 5 more minutes, Bill's going to ring and catch me again. But look at got to put the scriptures up there about the, let me go back one if you want to. It is an interesting study to go back. What have I done? There we go. To go back and look at those Old Testament references where you see back God gave. When you go back into Exodus, you see he gave some rules on about this bronze altar that everybody had access to daily. And then he had some very special rules for the golden altar, which was in the holiest of holies. And that's where the high priest went in one time. And that's where he represented the people to God one time a year. Okay, thank you for your attention. Next week we'll tackle chapter 9.